Good afternoon. So I'll begin with just a little bit of housekeeping, so to speak, here. Could we have a volunteer to take on an extra job to be a veggie chopper at 7:30 in the morning? An opportunity to be in the kitchen helping provide these fabulous food. Crispin, thank you. Thank you. Yesterday, I appreciated Gil ending his talk with these symptoms of inner peace, kind of this playful way of considering, you know, how peace might arise. And the first line of that was, "Watch for signs of peace. The hearts of a great many have already been exposed to it." And I thought, how often do we maybe not notice when there are some feelings of peace, when there are some feelings of well-being or some contentment, or might I even say a little bit of happiness? Instead, there's this encouragement, watch for signs of peace. It's just natural that, you know, as humans, we tend to gravitate towards the difficulties so that we can remain safe. And of course, we have evolved from beings that managed to stay safe. And right, so I think everybody is aware that there's humans have this negativity bias, tend to really notice what might be difficult. And but it's not the only thing that happens in our experience, of course. Sometimes it might be the predominant or might feel the most sticky, but it's not the only part of our experience, chances are. Recently, I had some pain in my knee, and you know, really when there's some difficulties, our focus just goes there, and I was uncomfortable, and having to get the cushions just right so that when I was in a meditation posture, you know, it wouldn't be too bad. But then it, you know, started to diminish and then it stopped. But I didn't notice when it stopped. But when I noticed that, oh yeah, I used to be bothered by this, but right now I'm not. There's this little bit of delight. This little bit of uplift, this tiny little bit of, oh yeah, I don't have that anymore. In some ways, it kind of reminds me of these little lizards that we see. I don't know, I have a little bit of delight when I see a lizard scampering around too. It's just, oh, go little guy, you know. So the Buddha also, he talked about this, how sometimes we don't notice these small little moments. Maybe they're big moments when there's that absence of a difficulty. But this delight is part of our experience and can be a support for practice, can be a tremendous support for practice and can nourish us and support us in a certain way. These small, seemingly mundane events that happen throughout the day. And the Buddha described it as this. Suppose a person were sick, suffering, and gravely ill. They'd lose their appetite and get physically weak. But after some time, they'd recover from that illness and regain their appetite and their strength. And thinking about this, they'd be filled with joy and happiness. So thinking about this, remembering that there used to be this great difficulty and it's no longer there, and some joy and happiness. And he talked about this the Buddha, and not only with regard to illness, but in other contexts, in the form of similes. And I like some of these stories or some of these imaginations. Suppose a person who has gotten into debt were to apply themselves to work and their efforts proved successful. They would pay off the original loan and have enough left over to support their family. Thinking about this, they'd be filled with joy and happiness. Suppose a person were imprisoned in a jail, but after some time they were released from jail, safe and sound and no loss of wealth. Thinking about this, they'd be filled with joy and happiness. Suppose a person were a bond servant. They belonged to someone else and were unable to go where they wished. But after some time, they'd be freed from servitude and become their own master, an emancipated individual able to go where they wished. Thinking about this, they'd be filled with joy and happiness. Suppose there were a person with wealth and property who was traveling along a desert road, but after some time they crossed over the desert, safe and sound and with no loss of wealth. Thinking about this, they'd be filled with joy and happiness. Sometimes our practice might feel like a little bit stuck in jail, or you know, kind of like a little bit imprisoned. I can't find our way, or maybe it feels like we're crossing a desert, not quite sure where we're going to find the water or if bandits are going to find us, it's not quite feeling safe or where to go. I mean, these are colorful ways to describe what sometimes can feel like some difficulties or ways in which we get stuck. And then also pointing to when we recognize that that stuckness, that difficulty is no longer there. The Buddha is using this word joy and happiness, but maybe we can expand that to mean something like more contentment or well-being or peace, delight. So tonight, I'd like to talk a little bit about this relationship between happiness and difficulties. I took these similes that the Buddha pointed to are about the happiness that arises when we notice that the difficulties are no longer there. But happiness also can support us with difficulties. Any sense of well-being, peace, delight. And noticing how actually the difficulties don't have to be absent for there to be some sense of well-being. It can be a trap if we think like, okay, I have to get rid of every single difficulty until I can have some well-being, until I can have some happiness. Of course, many of us want to do this, trying to make everything just be perfect. So then finally, I'll be happy. But part of this practice is pointing to how there can be some well-being in the midst of difficulties, as well as after them, as well as before them. So some of you might have recognized that the similes that I just talked about are the similes for these like five perennial ways in which our clarity gets obscured, in which we might get stuck, in which I was using the word difficulties, unique to every single human being, maybe I shouldn't use the word unique. Maybe it's universal in this way, right? We all have them. We often call these the five hindrances. But there's a way in which calling them hindrances, I feel like, colors our relationship to them, makes them something that's bad and then we have to get rid of, or something like this. I'd like to talk a little bit about how we can practice with them and transform them into something a little bit different without them having to go away, without us having to figure them out and solve them. And so how we might find our way, no matter what is arising, no matter what our experience is, find our way to greater freedom, greater happiness, greater peace. So these hindrances, these are like energies or habits or patterns. We could use the word obstruct, that get in the way. And broadly speaking, we could define them as, the first one is sensual desire, this craving for sensual desire. For me, I often kind of feel like there's a certain type of like leaning forward, like, I want more, I need more, give me more. The second one is ill will, just kind of the opposite for me. It's kind of like, give me less, I don't want it, please make it go away. I'll talk a little bit more about each of these. So the first two are like a leaning forward or a leaning back. Literally or metaphorically, sometimes in our meditation posture, we can notice if we're looking, like if there's a lot of desire, sometimes like the chin will go up and there'll be a little bit of leaning. You can just even like notice that. The next two, the first of the next two, so the third one, is what we call sloth and torpor. These are not words that are usually in my vocabulary, but I like the way that they sound. Torpor. Kind of has this fogginess, this maybe a kind of this lack of vitality in the body, a lack of brightness in the mind. A little bit like going through jello, maybe, or so that's when the energy is low. And then, of course, we have the opposite when the energy is high. This restlessness, this feeling fidgety, like the last thing we want to do is sit still. It's also sometimes called restlessness and worry. So it can be like this mental thing of just going over and over in our mind, oh, I shouldn't have done that. This kind of a little bit, maybe some regret or something, just playing that again over and over and over. And it has this power of its own, maybe. And then the last one is what we call doubt. But it's, for me, it's easier to understand. If I think of it, it's a way that's, it's not all doubt. It's a particular doubt. It's a doubt that gets in the way. So one that causes us to hesitate or to feel paralyzed. Like, I don't know what to do here. I'm going to do this. Oh, wait, no, maybe I'm going to do that. I'm going to do this practice. No, wait, I think I better do this practice. And then we just spend our whole meditation wondering what to do, or not wondering what to do, but maybe like going here and then going there and having some uncertainty. To be sure, this tradition really encourages some questioning. So we're not saying just accept everything, don't have any doubt. This type of doubt is the kind that has this paralyzing or has a hesitation or vacillation quality to it. So these experiences can be Like if we consider our practice or the momentum of our practice as maybe like a river that's flowing, these hindrances can be a little bit like sluices, like ways in which the water gets diverted. And so we lose a little bit of water here off the stream, and then maybe a little bit of water here. And then if our practice is going this way, it just starts to kind of fizzle out a little bit, lose some of its momentum, because some of it's the energy, the attention is going different directions. I want to reiterate that these ways of responding, reacting to our experience, are natural processes. I might even say, of course, the mind does this. Of course, the body does this. When they arise, and they will arise, some of you might have noticed, it doesn't mean you're a bad meditator. It means you're a meditator. Even the Buddha on the night of his enlightenment, right, he has this Mara's army. Mara sometimes is portrayed as a personification of difficulties. And Mara, with his army, is shooting arrows at the Buddha. And one version of the story, a colorful version of the story, has that the Buddha was able to meet these arrows of difficulties with mindfulness. And in the story, these arrows turn into flowers. And he finds himself with flowers as opposed to being impaled or something. So even the Buddha, on the eve of his awakening, had some of these experiences. I want to emphasize this just because for me, early in my practice, I so much thought I was a failed meditator just because I was having sometimes restlessness, all these, right? All the hindrances, and sometimes all five at once. And it's astounding the stories that we can make when these arise. And one way to talk about or explain this, what it is that they obscure, what they are covering, what they are hindering, is clear seeing. And seeing that these are just experiences that arise and then pass away. We don't have to take them personally. We don't have to turn a self-evaluation into these experiences. And of course, if we're going to have a mindfulness practice, that includes practicing with non-mindfulness. Includes practicing with the difficulties with mindfulness. But how could it be otherwise? So these five habits, these five patterns, these five energies, these five ways in which we might be responding to our experience. Is just what it means to meditate, is to be with these. They're natural arisings. So all of these hindrances, one thing that they share is they have this quality of maybe a restriction or a binding, a uncomfortableness or being stuck. They all share this type of a quality. And the commentary, so a little bit, not in the words of the Buddha, but somebody closer to that era says, for example, there is a person who has incurred a debt, but is unable to pay. Now, if their creditors, when telling them they have to pay back the debt, speak roughly or harass and beat them, the person in debt is unable to retaliate, but has to bear it all. This idea of you owe something to somebody, then you somehow you have to take what they are giving you. I don't know if we have to take this literally, but that idea of, oh, this is what's experiencing maybe the sense of helplessness or stuckness around it. And then this absence of the hindrances is more this feeling of release, this feeling of freedom, this feeling of peace, this feeling of joy and happiness, which the commentaries say, just as one who has freed themselves of debt no longer feels fear or anxiety when meeting their former creditors. I was thinking about, we have this, here we are thousands of years ago, as they're talking about debt and creditors. And I was thinking maybe a modern equivalent is when somebody sends you an email and you feel like, oh, I have to respond to that email. And sometimes I'm not always on top of my emails. So this feeling like, oh, here's that person. Oh, I owe them an email, right? That kind of that feeling. And that feeling when that's not there, it's like, oh, hi, how are you? So this relationship between the absence of the hindrances and the sense of release or freedom, peace, well-being, we could use kind of like all of these different flavors. That relationship goes both ways. It means also any sense of happiness or well-being can support the presence of any well-being, happiness, joy, peace, can support the absence of the hindrances. But it doesn't have to be like the biggest happiness. It doesn't have to be the biggest sense of well-being that can support the absence of the hindrances. There's this poem that I really like that speaks to this, how this any sense of well-being can help the hindrances diminish. Even that small little bit of delight, or maybe even too light, delight is too strong of a word, when we recognize what's happening with our mindfulness practice. Maybe we find swirling lost, and then we find ourselves, oh, a moment of mindfulness. This poem talks about blue herons. Maybe many of you know these birds. They're really big, right? I don't know, maybe 3 feet tall with like 6 feet wingspan. We often see them like standing still next to water, related to, the white herons also. These beautiful, majestic birds. And this poem goes like this. Nudged by hope, the heart rises from exhaustion. It's like the great blue heron I saw this morning, flying up from a wasteland on broad gray wings with strong, slow beats. For a moment, charged with grace, before. Did you see this heart? It chose to land again, bringing all its beauty to the desolate place. This bird being, the poet describes it as a wasteland, and leaving and then choosing to land again. In some ways, it's like how we just keep on coming back to practice, keep on coming back to the present moment. And there's a way in which, just like this beautiful bird lands, when the mindfulness shows up again, the way that it brightens, the poem is bringing all its beauty to the desolate place. So in some way, and whether it's subtle or obvious, it's a way in which transforming the place, it's no longer bleak, it's no longer desolate, it's no longer abandoned. But with our bringing our attention, we're bringing some brightness to that experience. So it can be a trap, as I mentioned, if we think that happiness or well-being is only available when the hindrances are absent. But there's a way in which we can bring our awareness to the difficulties. And this recognition, oh, I have a practice. It's not easy. It's not always exactly what I want to do, but there's a way I can work with this. There's a way that I can be with this experience, as opposed to maybe just feeling overwhelmed or feeling lost, not knowing what to do. Maybe just feeling tumbled or pushed around by our experiences. But when we recognize, oh, there's a practice. I've done this before. It doesn't mean that we'll be able to do it right then, that moment, to the full ability, and it'll go away. But just this recognition that mindfulness can be a way forward is a way that we can transform what is difficult into just another moment of mindfulness. And this moment of mindfulness can have a quality of ease, can have a quality of space. It might even have a quality of warmth, care, love. With what's difficult. So there's a number of ways we can practice with these ways in which we can feel stuck, or these ways in which we can feel like we don't have access to our wisdom, or these ways that we find ourselves believing all of our thoughts and they are not kind thoughts towards ourselves, or sometimes believing all the judgments that we might have, or whatever it might be, all the ways in which we might feel stuck. So now I'd like to talk a little bit about what are some ways we can work with these. Without it to hopefully trying to feel oppressive, like you have to do this. But sometimes it's helpful to know that there are tools in a toolbox. Sometimes you're so happy and you find yourself going to that toolbox a lot. sometimes it's just comforting to know that you have them. I've a first aid kit in the trunk of my car and a couple of little tools and stuff like this. I never had to use it, but it's something nice to know that I have it. But maybe this is really helpful. Maybe not. So you can find your way with it. Maybe it's something you put in the trunk of your car, so to speak, and for a rainy day or something like that. So when we find ourselves with these difficulties, with these hindrances, one of the first things is to just recognize, oh, this is one of those hindrance things. Just to recognize it can be helpful to label it. Oh, this is just restlessness. I've seen this before. And I live to tell about it. Oh, this is just sloth and torpor. Oh, this is doubt. And sometimes if we have some settledness and the conditions are such, sometimes that's sufficient for the kind of the compelling quality to kind of like drain out of that experience. But there's a way in which kind of recognizing is that instead of maybe wandering around in a maze with our head down, sometimes recognizing it is a way of kind of being able to look up above the maze. Maybe you're still in the maze, but you have like, oh, I'm in the maze, and now I can see I probably need to go this direction or something like that, as opposed to just feeling like stuck in the maze. There might be a little bit of delight. Oh, okay, I've seen this before. Doesn't have to mean anything. This is just what's happening. And along with this recognition is, as best we can we allow it to be there? It is there. And if we add some aversion on top of it, it's not going to help. It's like adding fire onto fire, right? So as best we can we allow it to be there? These are natural human responses. It's not uncommon for them to arise. And as I said earlier, there's no need to create a story about what they mean, what they don't mean. But it's enormously helpful to notice our relationship to the experience. Oh, this is restlessness. And I really dislike restlessness. I hate this feeling. Oh, there's aversion. I really dislike aversion. Oh, there's aversion to aversion. And then, right? And we can go aversion to aversion to aversion, right? But as long as we keep on noticing, that's a moment of mindfulness. And in that moment, we're no longer hindered. We're actually being aware. Oh, this is restlessness. But if you do nothing else on this retreat except start to recognize your relationship to these experiences, this can be transformative. Independent of having whatever experiences you were hoping or imagining that you might have, but just to notice how we work with difficulties, to notice our relationship with them. Do we tend to collapse? Do we tend to pretend they're not there? Do we tend to have this sense that we have to push through and make them go away? Do we just distract ourselves no matter what? We just find a way to distract ourselves. Whatever it might be. Because what we're discovering on the meditation cushion, right, of course, happens outside. The off the cushion in our daily life? Of course it does. We have one mind, one heart, one life experience. So this can be enormously transformative and supportive and life-changing. Just this idea of looking at our relationship to difficulties, even if the difficulties keep on arising, but just more opportunities for us to notice and practice with, oh yeah, here's that again. I was calling them habits and patterns because they do have a certain momentum in our life. Ways that we show up for our life. And can we allow them to be the way that they are without having to be some aversion to them? And there's something that just the allowing, the kind of the acceptance, the openness towards them, that allows something different to unfold than if we meet it the usual way, whatever the usual way might be for us. So we're helping to create the conditions in which something else might arise in the presence of these difficulties. Also, this idea of allowing it to be there is maybe a way in which we can soften the self-evaluation that often accompanies some difficulties. Maybe we could slow down some of the story making that happens when we encounter difficulties, some of the ways that we say, oh, this happens, it means this. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. Maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe what matters is right now this experience. For the purpose of our meditation practice, we can let the ideas about what it means just kind of wither away. So we're recognizing, allowing. And then is there a way that we can interrupt the momentum that these habits, these patterns have? Part of the way that we can do this, interrupt this momentum, is if it's a difficulty, if it's a hindrance that's primarily in the mind, let's say, that we find ourselves ruminating over a worry that we have or a regret that we have. I shouldn't have said that. Now, next time I see that person, I'm going to say this, or you know, something like this, kind of, or maybe rehearsing things we're going to say, or remembering things that we were said, or whatever it might be. So, one way to interrupt the momentum of that is to expand our mindfulness to include, if we're something's happening in the mind, to include the body. Just be aware of what's happening in the body. We can use some of what Gail talked about this morning is during the instructions. So then the thoughts start taking some of the authority of the thinking, some of the primacy or the believability of the thoughts, kind of take a power away from that a little bit and start paying attention. What does it feel like to have that experience, being lost in thought? If that doesn't feel quite available, then you're feeling really caught, just pay attention to what is the most obvious bodily experience at that moment. I'm often going to the pressure against my body. If I'm standing, the pressure against my feet. And that can kind of like help interrupt the momentum. And it works the other way too. If the difficulty is with the body, uncomfortableness and pain, or some restlessness, feeling like real agitation and fidgety and get me out of here kind of feeling. You can expand the awareness to go to the mind. Maybe ask this question of, what story is happening right now? Is there a way that I can soften that? What is supporting? What's underlying? What's fueling this restlessness, this feeling like I have to be somewhere else doing something else or something like that? So one way to interrupt the momentum, if it's something you're experiencing primarily as thought, is to go to the body. If you're experiencing it primarily in the body, to go to some thoughts and to see what some of the underlying beliefs are. So a number of ways we could think about that. One is just to expand what we're aware of. Sometimes when we're having difficulties, we tend to kind of like collapse around the difficulty and it becomes all consuming in some way. And I kind of did this with my body. There's this collapsing. But is there a way we can say, yes, this difficulty is here, and there's a sound, and I can feel the pressure against my body, and I'm breathing. So not denying, not repressing, not pretending it's not there, but just noticing what else is happening. And then something else we might do with we find ourselves with some of these difficulties is to not be in such a hurry that they have to go away, but have this opportunity, is there a way in which we might understand them better? We might understand ourselves better. Can these be opportunities for some learning, for some way in which we might gain some understanding that can support us in the future, the next time they arise? Or is there some understanding that we can have that helps us gain some familiarity? Like, oh, right. Okay. I know that when I'm starting to have this pain in my knee, then my attention kind of collapses around it. But if I can notice that my thoughts are about, oh my gosh, I'm going to ruin my knee and I'll never be able to walk again. But instead, if I just notice that it feels a little bit like a stabbing sensation, that's not too fast. In fact, it feels like it's slowing down. And that just kind of like also kind of disrupts the momentum, but also helps us to understand, oh, there are thoughts and there's bodily experiences. And they're kind of like compounding into this difficulty. So is there a way in which we can become curious? Like, what is this experience? How do I experience this in the mind and in the body? And that really can shift our relationship to be curious. When I'm feeling really tired, where do I feel it? Around the eyes often. Sometimes the shoulders can feel heavy. What's happening in the mind? Maybe the mind starts to drift little bit, and maybe there's a kind of collapsing of the posture. It's fascinating. I've spent plenty of time looking at slap and torpor, bringing this curiosity, and of course, looking at it, especially like with slap and torpor, sometimes it means that maybe you fall asleep, and then, oh, wow, that was amazing. I was mindful and then I wasn't. How did that, you know? There's this way that it can just be a support for our practice. We just become a little bit curious about them, not so that we can figure them out in such the sense that we have them, we understand them completely. But I'm talking about curiosity in the way that there's this open question. What is this? What does it feel like? And the goal is not that we have to find the answer. Answer might arise, but it's more the approach, it's more the attitude. What is this? I talked about mindfulness being a noticing practice. So this curiosity is a way which can encourage some noticing. And we can inquire, are there some underlying beliefs that we have that are fueling this difficulty, making it stick around, that it might be contributing or exacerbating them? Or we might just do a gentle inquiry. Sometimes this is done outside of retreat or outside of meditation, because again, the objective is not that we have to find the answer. The objective is to be open to what arises. So open to having the question. And the question might be, is this difficulty distracting me from something that's maybe deeper? Distracting me from something that I don't want to see, not ready to feel? The answer may bubble up. It may not. Meditation is not about doing this archaeological dig and getting the exact answer, but just to be open to this question. So maybe I'll talk a little bit more about one of these hindrances. This craving for a sense pleasure. Sometimes when this craving is around, we don't actually call it a doubt, or sorry, a hindrance very often. Instead, we say, I need this thing. No, I really need it. I need to take care of myself in this way. We absolutely want you to take care of yourself on this retreat. But part of the art of practice is recognizing, when is this just chasing after sense pleasure, after sense pleasure, after sense pleasure? And when is it really taking care of yourself? And this can be part of the art of practice too, is to understand that, the distinction. Sometimes just recognizing it, that it is present, can help us say, oh yeah, okay, this is just wanting some sense pleasure. And then maybe we don't have to chase after it. Allowing it to be there without adding any aversion. And then when there's sense pleasure, when we are craving for something, there's a way in which we are focused on the object. I need it. I want it. This will be a source of lasting happiness. I'm sure of it. As soon as I get this. And then with this practice, trying to turn around away from the object and look at what is the experience of this wanting? How does it feel to be wanting? This is a moment of mindfulness. Sometimes this wanting feels a little bit pleasant in the beginning. We have a sense of vitality. I'm going to go get that thing and then it's going to make me happy. But if we stay and feel into it, we see that it's really not that much of a happy state. It's subtle, but there can be this way in which there's a type of closing or a type of contraction. This way, kind of the Buddha talked about like being in debt or being imprisoned. My happiness somehow is tied up with having to get that thing. Or so there's a way in which if we feel this, we might recognize, oh, that's actually not so comfortable. And there can be a natural falling away, letting go. But not always, right? Because there is a momentum. These are habits. These are patterns. So is there a way that maybe we can turn toward any sense of okayness? Can we broaden our awareness to include anything that interrupts this wanting, wanting, wanting? Maybe there's this way which could relax the body, allowing, tuning into the breath. Allow, there's sometimes the breath can be a soothing, this kind of rhythm about it. Or maybe in the mind, we can relax the mind in some kind of way. Sometimes the mind can get a little bit stuck, or if it makes sense to you, this idea of opening. Sometimes sounds can help with that. And then when there is a little bit more space, I'm talking about like broadening, we may notice that it seems like there's two things that are kind of going on at the same time. There's the difficulty and some okayness. And of course, we want to focus on the difficulty, but can we also include any okayness? And I'm using okayness to be as vague as possible and not setting a very high bar. Because there's a way that if we just keep on looking for these sense pleasures, and to be sure our society really promotes this and wants us to do this, but there's a way in which we are, rather than nourishing ourselves, supporting ourselves with practice. It's a way in which we're kind of like nourishing and supporting that feeling of it's not enough. It's not enough. If we just keep on looking for more and more, feeding this hungry, the Buddhists have this expression, right? The hungry ghosts, maybe some of you have heard of this, that are never satisfied. But can we feed ourselves what's nourishing? And one way to do that is maybe ask ourselves, what's really lacking in this moment, this moment? Maybe there is a little bit of contentment, a bit of ease, a bit of peace. Maybe that's not your dominant experience. Maybe it's only a little sliver of your experience. Maybe it's only flickering there. Maybe it is your dominant experience, the whole range. Just this encouragement that sometimes we have this feeling that I have to solve this problem, make this thing go away, this experience to go away before there can be any more ease. And earlier I pointed out that does happen sometimes when difficulties and there is ease, but it's not the only time. So this happiness, this peace, this well-being, is there a way in which we can not forget about it, not ignore it, in whatever way it shows up. And I also want to say, sometimes we are in a lot of grief, and that's appropriate when we're having loss. Sometimes there's a lot of sadness. Sometimes there's some anger when there's been harm done. I want to honor and respect that also as an experience. So I don't want to talk about happiness and well-being and pretending like nothing else is happening. I don't want us to repress or anything like that. But maybe to just acknowledge that our experience is actually really varied. And it might be that mindfulness, bringing some mindfulness to our experience, can be kind of like that blue heron that lands back into the wasteland, bringing its beauty with it. It can be a little bit of some brightness, a little bit of delight, just the mindfulness. So the wisdom that's needed for working with these hindrances is discovered through the mindfulness of them. This wisdom is acquired slowly. I wish I could tell you guys, no problem, you'll get it by the end of Thursday. But there's something that we're cultivating while we're cultivating this, working with the difficulties, cultivating also patience, which, as some of you might know, is one of the qualities of the paramis. These are part of these qualities that really support awakening. As I said, it also requires mindfulness, some investigation, what's really happening. Tuning into any sense of well-being, maybe joy. Some of you may recognize that these three are factors of awakening, that support awakening. So there's this way with our being with the hindrances, being with difficulty, is the path, is precisely the path. Sometimes we think that, oh, I have to take care of this difficulty and then I'll get back to this awakening, freedom, peace, ease thing. It turns out that this is the way. What was like maybe some obstruction, we could say, playing with words, maybe obstruction becomes the object of mindfulness, and there we are, right, practicing. Because mindfulness is mindfulness of mindfulness. Gil and I are giving instructions on breath and the body. It doesn't have to be breath and body. We'll talk more about this in the retreat, but there's a way in which it's just another moment of mindfulness. So Buddhism recognizes when there's a hindrance-free mind, it's a beautiful mind. But there's a way in which just being mindful is beautiful. In its own way, and this beauty helps with the sense of peace and ease. Maybe I could stretch it and say happiness and joy. Maybe not. Maybe that I don't have to stretch it, but this is available for all of us. whether you're experiencing the 28th jhana or whatever that is, or you're really stuck with a lot of restlessness, whatever it might be, we can meet it. And in that meeting right there is the practice, and right there can be some sense of well-being, some happiness. Even if it is just for a moment. So let's sit just for a minute here. And if I had a bell near me, I would ring it at this time. So thank you. Thank you for your attention, and thank you for your practice.